Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Tonight, as part of our 2024 election coverage, we'll hear two different perspectives on Prop K, the proposal to permanently close the Great Highway. The issue has divided the Sunset neighborhood, and we'll be taking your calls and comments. And then we'll talk to music writer Michael Goldberg about his new book, Jukebox, 1967 to 2023. It features photos of rock musicians from the late 60s to the present era. But first, recently the San Francisco Standard published an article about a new form of fentanyl that is local. Referred to as soap. Usually it's the higher potency drugs that are cause for alarm, but with soap, it's the fact that it's less potent that is making it so popular. Here to tell us more is San Francisco Standard reporter David Shosted. David's reporting focuses on homelessness and addiction. Welcome back to State of the Bay, David.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, we're very happy to have you back. So a lot of us are familiar with the term fentanyl, but remind us, what makes it so potent, so deadly?
Yeah. So fentanyl is much more deadly than any other opioid we've seen. And San Francisco, for quite a while, has had some of the cheapest fentanyl anywhere in the country, which, you know, just a tiny dose can kill someone. But now, as you said, the supply of fentanyl has declined. So it's kind of, people have conflicting opinions about what that means for the city's drug crisis.
Well, when did soap first come on the streets, and where is it coming from?
Yeah, so soap is it's more of like a generic name for fentanyl that is diluted. It got that name, I think it's actually previous drug crises have had have used that name before to describe crack or other drugs that were diluted. And the name comes from the fact that dealers would, put shaved pieces of soap into a bag and sell it as if it was the drug. So it's not necessarily that there's this strain of soap fentanyl that's going around. It's more of like a slang term to describe fentanyl that's not as strong.
And what are they using to dilute it then?
It depends. I spoke with one outreach worker who said that one of her clients did a test and found that there was nail polish remover in the fentanyl that she was using.
Yipes.
And so what it's doing is people are consuming chemicals that they're really not sure what they're consuming. And, you know, their tolerance and their need for the drug has remained the same. So they're becoming more desperate is the issue.
And is it the users who are diluting it to make the fentanyl last longer, or is it the dealers, or is it both?
No, the general idea on the street, and from my past reporting, I've talked to drug policy experts who have said this is the case, that when there's more enforcement strategies from the city, as we're seeing right now, the product gets spread out so dealers can make more off less. So it's the dealers that are cutting it up. And as I said, there are conflicting opinions about it. So when I talk to the users on the street, a lot of them are very upset. Obviously, they're not getting the potency that they're used to. But there are people within the drug treatment and recovery community who say that it's actually, you know, a good thing, because people will overdose less because the drug isn't as strong. And so we've seen a couple months here where the overdose totals have gone down. It's always tough to say whether that's going to maintain or not, though.
So what I'm hearing is that maybe buying less potent versions of fentanyl is a good thing?
It definitely could be. It remains to be seen. But it, you know, it's tough to tell. I mean, you would think that if you're having less potent fentanyl, you're less likely to overdose. But people say that, you know, when the drug policy or when the drug supply shifts like this, we end up with maybe new drugs, or we end up with uncertain substances like that people aren't used to taking. And so it kind of just remains to be seen how the dealers respond moving forward. But As of now, our overdose totals have gone down 2 months in a row. So let's pray that that continues.
And do officials think that it's related to the lack of or the less potent fentanyl out there, or the fact that people are turning to other things?
Well, one thing that's frustrating for me as a journalist covering this is that the city doesn't actually track potency. I got some data from the DEA that shows statewide we've seen a decrease, but the city doesn't even know whether it's going down or not. This is my reporting was based on conversations with many people on the streets as well as outreach workers, and based on that DEA data. But the city wouldn't speculate, and they weren't even sure whether it had gone down or not locally.
Well, you mentioned that you, I mean, you've interviewed scores of local drug users to kind of understand how they are using and metabolizing this new form of fentanyl. You mentioned that people are concerned that it's not the drug that they thought they were purchasing. Were there any other issues that users have raised? I mean, is there fear that there might be something else that's not great for them in that's cut into this drug?
Yeah, I think people, when people hear that oh, there's something else that's not great for them in the drug, you might get some eye rolls because fentanyl is obviously
Yes,
one of the worst things
exactly.
you can consume. But it changes things for people on the street. And I spoke, so I'll give a couple examples of people I spoke to. There was one guy. A lot of these people consider the opioids their medicine. No matter what you think about that, that's what they think. And I met one man who lived in Mendocino, and he would come down, he said, maybe once or twice a month to pick up fentanyl from San Francisco. And he told me that as the quality has gone down, his visits became more frequent until he was eventually actually living on the street in San Francisco because he just needed a more constant fix from the less pure fentanyl, which they were calling soap. And he was sitting there on the Tenderloin sidewalk next to suitcases filled with his belongings. I met another man who said he's been trying to get into treatment, and he felt that it was actually harder now because he every 15 to 45 minutes he needs the redose on the fentanyl. But it's really hard. I try to give people all the voice I can on the street. But you also have to understand that addiction is a disease where people can tell themselves things, because they want to get high. They want to continue getting high. And as I said, there were people on the side of things saying, yeah, this is a good thing. I spoke with somebody from a nonprofit called West Side Community Services who said he's seen an increase of people actually seeking treatment. So again, let's hope that that continues.
We've heard a lot that when people do overdose on fentanyl, that Narcan is something that helps and re over is an antidote. Is the same true with a lesser dose of fentanyl? I assume yes.
Yes, yeah, definitely. Actually, we were concerned for a while because there was all these rumors of stronger fentanyls, whether they were versions of fentanyl or basically a new type of fentanyl that had emerged in certain parts of the East Coast. And a lot of times those drugs will then migrate across the country to the West Coast. And there were some local politicians and advocates and people in the scene who were concerned that the fentanyl would get stronger in San Francisco. We saw that there was some of those different versions types of fentanyl coming into our local supply in the last year or two, and now we're seeing the opposite. Those drugs are less. It's harder to reverse them with Narcan. So. From that perspective, the lower potency is definitely a good thing, I would think.
Well, you mentioned in previous drug crises with other types of illicit drugs like meth or cocaine that there is a version of lesser potency. That's where this phrase soap comes from. And another drug comes to take its place. Are we seeing other drugs out there that you think might become the new fentanyl?
There are a few. I mean, I don't know the new fentanyl. It's depressing to think that there could be. You know, but I would say right now I'm not seeing a trend towards stronger drugs making their way into the local market. We see things like Trank. Was I think the last time I came on here we talked about Trank, and these drugs present new dangers to people who are addicted to drugs, but they aren't necessarily more potent in that people are more likely to overdose. So Trank, you know, you get bad skin diseases and have higher likelihood of losing your limbs and falling into deep states of sedation where you can be robbed if you're living on the street, but you can't actually, the chances of fatally overdosing on Trank are far lower than fentanyl. So if we do see new drugs, and the new drugs that we have seen, they haven't necessarily posed a higher risk of lethality. As fentanyl.
Well, David, you also cover homelessness, and you know we're in a period right now where London Breed has authorized aggressive sweeps of encampments. Has that changed anything with relation to what's happening in the Tenderloin or areas where drugs like Trank and fentanyl are popular? Is that helping in any way?
You know, I think that people are moving around a lot more. And there are concerns that, you know, people who might suffer from mental illness may lose their medication that they need in these sweeps that are happening. As far as, you know, enforcement of drugs, this has been a sustained effort from the city over the past, I think it was last May, they launched their drug crackdown, as people are calling it, and they've done thousands of arrests since then. So I think this homeless encampment enforcement is affecting a different population than that. I think that there are people who are, you know, losing their belongings, and it's a different issue than the drug crisis. For the most part.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. I mean, thank you so much for joining us, David, and keeping us up to date about what's happening.
Definitely. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, that was David Schoestead of the San Francisco Standard. And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk about Prop K or the Great Highway Closure. That's right after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. We're launching our 2024 election coverage by talking about Prop K, which would permanently close the Great Highway to cars and turn it into a new park. If you've never been there, it's just on the edge of the city on the west side. Passions are high about this ballot measure, and it's pitting neighbors against neighbors. We'd love to hear what you're thinking about the prospect of the Great Highway closing. Are you a resident of the Sunset? How will you vote on this measure? And do you think San Francisco needs a new park, or should the Great Highway stay open for cars? Give us a call with your questions or comments. We're at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. It's your chance to weigh in about the Great Highway. You can also find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. To talk about the proposition, we're joined tonight by two residents of the Sunset, one on each side of the issue. First, we're joined by the board president of Friends of the Great Highway, and that is Lucas Lux. Welcome to State of the Bay, Lucas.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great. And we also have Josephine Zhao. She's the president of the Chinese American Democratic Club. Welcome, Josephine.
Thank you.
Yeah. So Prop K was co-sponsored by Sunset District Supervisor Joel Engardio, and it has the support of five supervisors. Before we dive into the conversation, let's hear what the supervisor had to say at a KALW live event a few weeks ago. He does a pretty good job of laying out what it would entail if the measure passed. Here's a listen.
Why transform a section of the Great Highway into a oceanside park? I believe it will help the environment, boost local merchants, and bring people joy. And when we say close or open the Great Highway, we're not talking about the entire Great Highway. There's three different sections. There's the section south of Sloat, there's a section between Lincoln and Sloat, and the section north of Lincoln that connects the Richmond and Sunset neighborhoods. We also have to understand three questions. What's already been decided? What's proposed for the future? And what's staying the same? The section south of Sloat is falling into the ocean due to coastal erosion. It's already legislated to close, so that's what's already been decided. The Great Highway has lost its greatest utility as a direct connection to Daly City. So now we have to decide what's the best use of the section between Lincoln and Sloat, which doesn't have any on and off ramps for cars. So turning this section into a park is what's being proposed. And the Great Highway between the Richmond District and Lincoln will remain open to cars 24/7 for access to the Sunset District, just as it always has. That's what's staying the same. So imagine how small businesses can benefit if the Sunset is home to an iconic park where every tourist wants to visit. Two train lines offer a direct ride to the beach. So imagine the tremendous spillover effect for our businesses. And think of the future generations who will get better access to the coast and a gathering place for exercise, art, music, and culture. So this is a once-in-a-century opportunity to bring a renaissance to San Francisco and the Sunset District. And we can have all this benefit while also making traffic flow improvements to ensure everyone can get where they need to go. So that's why Prop K is on the ballot. Voters should get to decide what to do with our precious coast, and that's what we're here to discuss.
So that was Joel Engardio, supervisor for the Sunset District, District 5, at a KALW live event, talking about why Prop K was on the ballot and what the measure would close and not close. Josephine Zhao, I want to start with you. What do you think Supervisor Engardio missed?
I think Supervisor Joel Engardio, who's the supervisor for District 4, the Sunset District, does not understand that Prop K poses an existential threat to the West Side and Asian community where he has jurisdiction of. It is a permanent road closure of Great Highway and no funding for a park. 20,000 people a day use the Great Highway to go to work, take kids to school, take themselves to clinic. Yeah, these are the working families, seniors, disabled, and we are cooks, custodians, and handymen. We physically have to go to work. Prop K put recreation above the survival of working families and placed tourists above long-time residents. It breaks a promise of a three-year pilot and overturned an agreed-upon promise compromise in order to make a generational change without us.
Mm. Lucas, what do you think about Supervisor Engardio's take?
I think he's spot on. I think that in our last segment, we heard a bit about some of the challenging parts of San Francisco right now. And Proposition K gives San Francisco an opportunity to show that we can still do big, great things. And we couldn't have asked for a better opportunity to be placed in our laps. We have a road that already closes frequently because of sand buildup. 32 to 65 days a year, that road is unavailable, and we have to use a different route. And we have a road that almost 80% of the trips are going to and from South Bay. The southern part of that road is closing, so those trips are going to have to go inland with or without Prop K. So we've got a road that's not doing a lot of work for us, and then we've got a park opportunity that all we did was just open a space to people, and they filled it. Almost 10,000 people every weekend are coming out because they want to enjoy the coast. And that's without adding so much as a park bench or any art or any other park features that people expect. They're just there for the ocean. And that shows us a glimpse of the possibility if we lean into this opportunity that San Francisco has. The data has been very clear. traffic on Great Highway is down 40%. The traffic impact on all those days that the sand closes the road, it only takes 3 minutes longer under present conditions with no improvements made to get from the outer Richmond to the South Bay. The cost of this opportunity could not be much lower relative to what it contributes to the community and what we could give to our children.
Lucas, when the supervisor talks about putting a park there, and what you've described is like you don't even have to do anything. You could just have two kind of roadways and that would be park enough. Is that right? Is it park enough to just have just the space to walk?
That's what's so interesting about this debate is we seem to have lost the plot a bit on is this a park? And almost 10,000 people a weekend go there because they think it's a great park. It's already, with no improvements, the city's third most visited park space because there's something innate about being close to the ocean, hearing the waves, and walking on a wide space for people that people enjoy. Right. And so what Prop K guarantees is more of that and enables simple improvements like adding park benches for seniors, adding art, all these types of things that can be done in the existing park budget. What Prop K also enables but does not mandate is a larger park redesign. Right. And so I think the critique that there's no funding for a park or there's no park plan is there's imagining that we could turn our west side into like a Crissy Field along the ocean, right? And Prop K doesn't mandate that because we don't go to the ballot box for a park design. But it's an incredible opportunity to start that work. But we can't do that until we first set aside the land for park use, which is what Prop K does.
One last question on that. I mean, if the sand is too much for you a car to traverse that area, how is it okay for making it into a park? Doesn't it just become sand dunes?
That's a great question, and there's two parts of the answer. One is the sand is in the roadway because our dunes are eroding. That's been happening for decades, and our city's not taken care of them as well as we should have. Fortunately, there's research on measures that we can implement to reduce the amount of sand coming into the roadway, which is very important to keep the water from storms out of because of rising seas out of the Outer Sunset neighborhood. So that's the first part. The second is there will still need to be sand clearance on a park. The city controller has estimated that the reduced sand clearance that you can have with a park promenade relative to a roadway would save up to $700,000 a year. The city currently spends $1.7 million a year on sand clearance. So you're saving money by clearing sand a little bit more frequently. You don't need all four lanes clear at all times to be safe to cars, right? But you're still going to have some costs until you can restore the dunes, which Prop K also enables you to do better.
Mm-hmm. Josephine, I wanted to address your point that the feeling that this was a proposition that didn't really include the community and that the community was somehow left out of the process of deciding what to do with the Great Highway. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I mean, this is totally an issue that Westside community needs to hear about, but we heard about it after the fact when it was submitted the last minute right before the deadline for the November ballot submission. And we felt really slighted because the people of Parkside and as well as the Gary Greater Merchant Association both are up in arm against this. If this proposition is so good, why couldn't you tell us ahead of time? Why wouldn't the Merchant Association be overjoyed? But no, people like us who are parents, who are parents of two former students at Ulloa Elementary School, I'm upset because I drove that road for 8 years, taking my kids to and from school and then myself to and from work. Mm-hmm. Without that road, it would take us a lot more time. It's not 3 more minutes. Mm-hmm. On the Great Highway, it's 7 minutes, mm-hmm. all synced lights. But the alternative route, which is under construction, the mitigation for traffic, mitigation is not done. That right now is twice as long because it has 16 lights and then 4-5 stop signs.
Mm. And what street would that be?
The Sunset Boulevard, Lincoln to Sunset.
Lincoln to Sunset. And do you feel that in terms of, I mean, one part of it is already going to close, right? We heard Ingardio say that because of erosion. Is it important to keep the other two parts of the highway open for this commute that you just described?
Well, I think that lower Great Highway, you know, the southern span of the Great Highway that it closes, we didn't even care about. 2 years ago, when that decision was made, I wasn't involved. because I didn't use it. Most of the time, we're just driving around the city. The people that use it the most, the 20,000 people a day that uses it, are within the Sunset and Richmond District. The west side, the Richmond District, is very much dependent on it. Without it, it's all boxed in. The Sunset District, though, without it, it's harder for us to access the southern schools, which is like Yuloa Elementary School. It's about 500-600 students, right? It has a bilingual education, and a lot of people from the Sunset and everywhere come uses it. And we still don't have neighborhood assignment, where we have to go to Chinatown. If we don't have that quick access to go there, it would take a long time. People like us have 16-hour days. We have to get our kids to school by 8, and then we have to get to work by 9. And then we don't take lunch break, and straight dashing out of the work at 5 in order to do a mad dash to pick up grocery and to pick up 2 kids. Otherwise, if you don't pick up by 6 o'clock, after school program is going to fine us $25 a kid for every for 1 minute that you're late.
I mean, that's a tough thing. Let's go to the phones and hear from some of our listeners. Michael from San Francisco, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hi, can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine. Thanks for calling us.
Great, thank you. Yes, my name is Michael. I was reminded today that it's the 4th anniversary of Orange Sky Day here in San Francisco, and I'd love to hear what either side of the Prop K debate, how they feel that their side, their views fit in with the city's climate plans.
That's a really good question. And Orange Sky Day, you mean the day that the sky literally turned orange because of all the wildfire smoke?
Yes, not a Giants Day.
Not a Giants Day, no. I think we all remember that day. I mean, Lucas, let me ask you, putting a park there seems to be a good thing for the climate. What do you think about Michael's question?
Yeah, I agree with you. And so does every major environmental group in the city, from Surfrider Foundation to Sierra Club, Golden Gate Bird Alliance. This is Prop K is good for the climate. It is good for the coastal ecosystem. This is our last dune ecosystem remaining in the city, and it is good for the wildlife that call it home. Right now, the major contributor of pollution in our oceans is the microplastics from car brakes and tires. And today that goes directly into our ocean. And Prop K gives us an opportunity to remove that pollution from going directly into our ocean. And the second thing that Prop K does that's critical for the Outer Sunset residents where I live is the combination of the rising seas and the eroding dunes means that stormwater and sea levels as they get higher are going to reach the neighborhood within my kids' lifetime, if not sooner. And this gives us an opportunity to rehabilitate the dunes and prioritize that over looking at the coast as a place where we can get from one place to another a couple minutes faster.
And Josephine, what do you say to that? You know, a park over having a roadway, and certainly, as you described it, the alternative roadway would take a little bit longer for you to traverse, and you have a very impacted day, and you need to get to places quickly. But does that resonate with you, that there might be a positive climate impact from Prop K, or do you disagree with that?
We all need to worry about climate change. It's an existential threat to everyone. How we tackle that has different opinions and different sides. On one hand, that there is a professor, earth science at Stanford professor. He said that the sand dune actually got restored naturally between 1987, when it was like very thin, and to now in 2022, it has expanded to over 500 feet. So that's a positive sign. But if we talk about cars' impact to environment, if we're moving the cars inland, that will just make it driving more, there are more driving and more cars going to sit on the road, and there's more emission. And then there's more impact to the Vision Zero goals, because the more you drive, the longer the drivers have having fatigue, the easier it is for us to make mistakes. So we need to find a better way to support both. There's a way to support the Great Highway, using it as a commute as well as using it as a recreation. We can think about technology and other compromises to maybe build enclosure for the Great Highway or something else. Because if you're going to spend $1.7 million a year to clear the sand and try to like get rid of that responsibility, maybe we can better use of that money and think about something else. But right now, Prop K does not allow us to make any compromise.
Well, let me reintroduce the program. This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7, KALW Bay Area, and I'm your host, Grace Wan. We're discussing Prop K, the Great Highway closure, and we'd love to hear from you. How would closing the Great Highway impact you, and are you concerned with coastal erosion or concerned about a commute that might be impacted by the closure of the highway? You can join us by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. We're talking tonight to the Friends of the Great Highway Board President, Lucas Lux, and Josephine Zhao, President of the Chinese American Democratic Club. And let's go back to the phones. Let's see. We have on line two, Jasmine from San Francisco. Welcome to the State of the Bay, Jasmine.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah. What's your take on Prop K?
Well, as a native San Franciscan and a Sunset resident, those of us who have seen this compromise that's currently happening on the weekends, where the Great Highway is already closed on Saturdays and Sundays, we see the difference, and we see the increase in traffic and congestion in the neighborhood. And on the weekends, you know, we're tolerating it, but we see a lot of frustrated drivers zigzagging through our neighborhood and trying to get where they're going because the Great Highway isn't open and available to them. So I think the most important thing people need to know is that this has real impact on the residents of the Sunset, and Prop K does not create a park. They keep using the word park when they're talking about it, but really what it creates is an abandoned road, and there's no money in this proposition for a park, and there's no way to raise the hundreds of millions of dollars that it would take to create a park. So it's an essential part of the West Side infrastructure, serving 20,000 people a day, and displacing them would be catastrophic for our neighborhood. And the current compromise with closure on the weekend seems to be working, and there's already an existing promenade which runs parallel to the Great Highway, and it's suitable for pedestrians and cyclists. And, you know, anybody who's been there on a weekend knows that there aren't 10,000 people there on any Saturday or Sunday. We've seen documentation of this. And I really think Chrissy Field is not a fair comparison because it didn't displace 20,000 motorists a day in order to be created. You know, the west side of San Francisco really does not suffer from a lack of parks. Mm. We have one of the highest ratings on Park Score, which is Trust for Public Lands way of rating how many parks per capita in any major city in the country.
Well, thank you.
I think it's important.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling in, Jasmine. And I wanted to take those comments to you, Lucas. I mean, here Jasmine is saying she's really concerned about the traffic being diverted from the Great Highway onto smaller streets and possibly creating pedestrian issues.
Yeah, and so I appreciate that question as a resident of the Outer Sunset, and I want to cover a couple things to respond to Jasmine. First, I understand I hear the question about what about a compromise? And it's interesting because we seem to have a short memory that the opponents to Proposition K have done everything under their power to remove what they currently call the compromise over the last 4 years. They sued the city. They sponsored a ballot proposition 2 years ago to put cars back on the Great Highway 24/7, 365 forever. They lost that. They went to the Board of Supervisors to try to take Fridays back for cars. They lost that. And then just this year, they went in an appeal all the way to the Coastal Commission, asking the Coastal Commission to take away the weekend pilot. And so I don't want your listeners to be confused to think that what the opponents to Prop K are championing is a compromise. What they want is cars back on the Great Highway 24/7, 365, because that is what all of their actions have asked for over the past few years. And then with respect to the traffic, there's a couple things. One, traffic in all of the relevant streets, we have clear data, MTA can count cars. It is significantly below pre-pandemic levels. Great Highway has 38% less traffic. Lower Great Highway has almost half as much traffic as it had before the before the pandemic. Sunset Boulevard has 30% less traffic. We don't have a traffic volume problem from this pilot. The problem that our neighborhood has is traffic speed. And that is a problem that is independent of the Great Highway as a promenade. And there's great data to demonstrate this. On the Lower Great Highway, for example, the average speed pre-pandemic in a residential street was 33 miles an hour. The city implemented, along with the pilot, some simple traffic calming measures that succeeded in bringing the average speed on this residential street down to 26 miles an hour. So our city has the tools to tackle these traffic issues without handing the coast over to cars to make it inaccessible for people pushing a stroller, walking into their wheelchair, teaching their kids how to ride a bike. Those are all the opportunities that we have. If we hand over our coast to people to enjoy in different ways, we can still solve all the traffic problems, and we want that too because we live in the same neighborhood.
Mm. What do you say to people who access the coastline by a car exclusively? You know, I don't know that Muni is so great getting out there in terms of when people want to go with their picnic baskets or whatnot. I mean, the car is a way to get to Ocean Beach, you know. So what do you say to people who say, I need my car to actually enjoy this area because I don't live in the Sunset. I live on the other side of town.
Oh, absolutely. And people, especially you see surfers, for example, driving out to the Great Highway to check out the surf and go out and enjoy the ocean. And what I say to them is, you're very lucky because this portion that Prop K would impact has no parking spaces, no turnoffs. It is not a roadway that is used for coastal access. And the Coastal Commission has spoken to this because almost 80% of the trips are going from the going to and from the South Bay. And so if you want to access the ocean by car, come enjoy our chunk of the ocean in San Francisco. But people who drive want to do that, want to enjoy the ocean with their kids or with their elders and their family on a promenade as well. This isn't a driver versus everyone else issue. This is about whether this particular piece of our coast is a place where we prioritize getting from A to B, or is it a place where we want to be? And we are saying that the coast is a place where everyone wants to be, and we've seen the Rec Park data that proves it, tracking almost 10,000 visits every weekend.
And Josephine, I want to ask you, why should we prioritize a commute along a roadway over creating open space? I mean, I think, for example, when they took down the Embarcadero Freeway, I mean, obviously the earthquake took it down and they didn't rebuild it. I don't think anybody's really sad about losing the Embarcadero Freeway. I mean, do you think that the Great Highway and closing that part could of the highway could be as transformational to the west side as closing the Embarcadero Freeway was to the east side?
Well, I don't think that's a fair comparison because the Great Highway is still a functioning road for 20,000 people a day to use it. And we are working people that have to go to work. We are the custodians, the cooks. We are the one that bring you your food and your delivery. If we can't survive in this city, our city is not going to function. And it's not just about driving. It's about, like, how are we going to survive, right? If we can't make that commute, we will have to be priced out of the city. We can't do that. We can't make that commitment. I also wanted to dispute that this road with 20,000 cars coming down the neighborhood, doesn't matter what kind of impact, it's not going to be able to sustain it. It's not a speed problem. It's a volume problem. Even if the Sunset Boulevard is maybe 70% of its original volume and this Great Highway still has, you know, 20,000 cars. How are you going to fit that four additional lane into the existing four lanes? That is not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And also, there more than that, we have already a lot of parks. We have the tunnel top that spent $120 million. We just opened the park in the Yerba Buena Island. Mm-hmm. That happened four months ago. And think about funding. Right now, when you talk about closing the Great Highway, you don't need any spending. Just the cost saving would be good enough. But think about Slow Sanchez. Slow Sanchez closed down to, you know, drive-through cars. Yet at the same time, the year later, we saw $270,000 being asked to spend on Slow Sanchez. Right now, this is just the first step of closing the road and making 20,000 people not able to go to work. We don't know what is the future going to be to really spend on the Great Highway Park. But if we're going to spend that kind of money on treating the environment and making it more friendly and more welcoming, we should do that right now to make sure that the current community can be remodeled, before the closure of the Great Highway.
Well, let's go back to the phones. We've got Judy from San Francisco on line one. Judy, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you just fine. What's your take on Prop K?
Okay, for one thing, the people who are saying they want no on K are not the people who put it on the ballot. The people who want no on K want the Great Highway to be shared, to have the lanes of traffic go the way they are, helping the commuters, helping everybody who needs to drive, and there are many people who need to drive. It's also a beautiful scenic route along the coast, but it is already an open space that is shared with everyone. There is a huge 10-foot paved promenade where people walk and bike. There are two road shoulders that are 4 feet wide for bicyclists who have never gotten hurt on the Great Highway, or maybe a handful of accidents have happened over decades on the Great Highway. That's because it doesn't have those on-ramps Engardia was talking about. That's because it has no intersections, and because of that, it is the city's best example of Vision Zero and the best thing that we have. And so it is right now, when it's open during the week, it is a shared space where everybody shares it. What this proposition does is this closes it completely. This floods the neighborhood with traffic. There is no mitigation they have done that's worked. There was just a huge accident on Lincoln and 41st Avenue this past weekend. That's because the traffic is diverted off of the highway into the neighborhood. And I would like to dispute the comment that there are 10,000 people using this every weekend. The only time there are 10,000 people or anywhere close to it is when there's a citywide event that has been heavily advertised and everybody has been called to the area. And then they come. And so the people who are trying to close the highway permanently from cars are the people who are calling these events. And they do about one a month. But if you would look at a weekend like this past weekend, there was nowhere near 10,000 people on there because there was no event. So it was also windy. It was cold. It's not really conducive for that. I also dispute that the Great Highway was closed something like 65 days this year. No, the Public Works closes the highway to do sand removal in June. It's got a couple of lanes that they close when they do that, but it's only sporadically closed. And this past year, they have not closed all four lanes to remove sand. They've just hours of closing it on the southbound side.
Well, Judy, thank you so much for those comments. Appreciate your perspective on this. It does feel like most of these calls are anti-Proposition K. And with the minute we have left, I want to give each of you a chance to give me your very best argument as to why you should vote in favor or against this proposition. I'm going to start with you, Josephine. You've got 30 seconds.
Prop K is just a road closure. There's no plan, no funding for any park. It's going to make people who are working in the city so much harder to make the people who make your food and bring your delivery that won't be able to stay in the city. Our city has lost our way. So no on K.
And Lucas, what's your best argument in favor of K?
I think you framed it perfectly. If we pass K in 5 years, will we ever look back? It took four ballot propositions to have what we know today as the Embarcadero Promenade. It took four ballot propositions to have what we know today as Hayes Valley. Some of those ballot propositions were put on by sunset merchants from my neighborhood trying to keep the freeway for their convenience. This is no different, except that we have one of the most special places in this city where we have an opportunity to enjoy it as a park space. And we have very clear data that I understand some of the callers don't believe, but that doesn't make it not true. We have very clear data from city agencies on the small traffic impact, the small price to pay, and how we actually save money in the near term. And so in a time where San Francisco is facing challenges, what an incredible opportunity for us to lean into and enjoy the most beautiful place in our city together.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. I want to thank both of you for joining us. That was Lucas Lux, board president of Friends of the Great Highway Park. Thank you for joining us, Lucas.
Thank you so much.
And Josephine Zhao, president of the Chinese American Democratic Club. Thank you for joining us, Josephine.
Thank you.
I want to remind our listeners that you can go to the live events page on KALW.org to hear the full hour of debate on Prop K. And coming up after the break, rock and roll history on View and the Hate. We'll hear about it when we come back. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Our next guest tonight is writer, music lover, and photographer Michael Goldberg. The photos in his new book, Jukebox, Photographs 1967 to 2023, are drawn from the thousands he's taken over the past 50 years. Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones, the Grateful Dead, Janis Joplin, Neil Young, and many more. They're all in the book, and most of the photos were taken right here in the Bay Area. Michael Goldberg, welcome back to State of the Bay.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Oh, it's so nice to have you. You know, I was looking through your book, which is quite beautiful, and there's a line in there that you wrote something to the effect of, a camera is like a passport, which really resonated with me, but I wanted to understand, what did you mean by that?
Well, actually, I think that was the photographer, Chester Simpson.
Okay, well, yes. Let's give you a little, yes. I will credit where credit's due.
You know, I think Chester, what he meant by that was that, you know, if you're a rock and roll photographer, then it allows you to get backstage. It allows you to get, at least in days past it did, you know, backstage or into a dressing room or right up at the front of the audience or onto the stage. To take photographs. So I think that's what he meant.
You know, I was curious. I mean, these days, everybody has a camera on their phone. Is coming in with a camera, a physical camera, different than coming in with your phone? Is the camera more welcoming than maybe a camera on your phone is?
Well, I think that the main thing at this point in time about a serious camera is that it makes the musician think, well, this is a real photographer. This isn't just somebody with their cell phone. But in fact, already that's beginning to change, because the cameras and the iPhones, the latest iPhones, are so good that I know professional photographers now who are using their cell phone and not bringing their cameras anymore.
Hard to believe. But yeah, I mean, they are really good. Well, on the cover of your book, you have this photo of Jim Morrison that you took when you were just barely a teenager. This was at the beginning of the Summer of Love. Tell us how you got that shot.
Well, it's actually the Jim Morrison shot is the first shot inside the book.
Ah.
I was 13, and the first rock festival in the country and possibly the world happened on Mount Tamalpais. It was the Magic Mountain Fantasy Fair and Music Festival, and it took place in June of 1967, a week before the Monterey Pop Festival, and it was 2 days. And they would bust everybody up there, because there was no way that all the cars would have been able to find a place to park up on Mount Tam near the amphitheater. So they bussed everybody up, and Jim Morrison, the Doors, were the headliner of the first day. And I was 13. I brought my Brownie camera with me, with one roll of film in it. Not really sure what was going to be possible. I'd never taken a photograph of a musician before, but I was able to get very right up to the front of the stage and took some pictures of Jim Morrison and Ray Manzarek, the keyboard player. And so I included one in the book. It was pretty thrilling to see the Doors when I was 13, and, you know, Light My Fire was on the radio. It was
decades ago, but I could still hear the excitement in your voice. Like, you are still that 13-year-old.
Well, I'm a very, I get very excited, and I'm kind of obsessive about everything that has to do with music and film and writing and reading and art. And that photo takes me right back to that day.
Well, I love that you were just 13. I think for parents out there, they're probably like, I would never let my 13-year-old go to a rock concert, much less, you know, leave him alone with a camera. As you think about it now, can you even believe that your parents let you do that?
Back then, it was very different. It was just so different. I mean, people weren't worried about, you know, kids getting kidnapped or or other kinds of horrible things. It just wasn't like that. And, you know, they were busing people up to, you know, up to the amphitheater, and they were busing them back down. And, you know, I don't think it, my parents weren't worried about it. I mean, they figured, well, he's going to this all day rock events, you know, that's fine. They had actually, for my birthday, they had driven me to San Francisco and let me and some friends go to the Avalon Ballroom, which was one of the two major rock places in the 60s in San Francisco. And they dropped us off, and we went in. We saw Big Brother and the Holdy Company with Janis Joplin. And then when it was over, we came out, and they picked, like, I don't know what they did for the 3 hours we were in there, but they were there when we came out.
Well, obviously, you had the coolest parents, Michael. I mean, that's pretty clear. You also have, I mean, as we were talking about in the intro, I mean, photos of the dead, and you have a picture of Jerry Garcia. I think that one was that taken at his home in Larkspur with Mountain Girl? Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
How did that one happen?
Well, this was crazy. Okay, I'm 17, and me and a friend of mine have decided we are going to start publishing the first Bay Area rock magazine. It's going to be like a Bay Area version of Rolling Stone. And I looked into it. I found out how much it would cost to have it printed. And so this is something we're going to do. Okay. So we have a friend, Tom Donahue Jr., who is the son of the famous disc jockey, record company president, concert promoter, Tom Donahue, who started KMPX, the first underground FM rock station in the country. So his son was in one of my classes, and me and my friend had become friends with him. And so we're going to go up to visit him. I parked my car a little bit on Mount Tam, a little bit down the road from where his house is. We walk up to what is the top of the driveway that leads down to the house, and standing there is Jerry Garcia. And I just went up to him and I told him that we were starting this rock magazine and we'd like him to be on the cover. And, you know, could we interview him? And amazingly, he looks at us and he says, yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And not only that, he gives me his address in Larkspur, and he says, you know, come, you know, something like, come next Tuesday night at 6 p.m. And so the next Tuesday, or when it, you know, whenever it actually was, but I mean, it was that kind of thing. It was, he wanted us to show up around 6, you know, one day the next week. And so we get there, and I'm carrying a reel-to-reel tape recorder that is 3 feet wide by 2 feet tall. I'm carrying that, and I have a camera, you know, around my neck, and then a couple of friends with me who are going to do the interview with me. And we knock on the door, and Mountain Girl answers the door. And she looks at us, and, you know, she sees these teenagers, and it's just like, yeah, you know, she says, What do you want? What is this? You know, because she sees the tape recorder too, you know. And I said, well, we're supposed to interview Jerry Garcia right now. And she's like, that's really odd, because he's getting ready to leave for the Keystone Berkeley. He's got a gig tonight. And I said, well, that's weird, because he said we could do interview him. So she says, hold on a minute. And she closes the door. She goes in. She comes back, and then she says, come on in. And she leads us into the living room, and there's Jerry Garcia. And apparently he had completely forgotten about this.
Why am I not surprised by that?
So, you know, I quickly, you know, got the tape recorder plugged in, got a microphone plugged into it. And so the three of us interviewed him for about half an hour, and I took some photographs while we were interviewing him. And then when we were done with the interview, I took, you know, I probably took about 12 pictures of him altogether. And got some nice portraits, and I included some of those in the book.
It's such a great story. I mean, it has almost famous Cameron Crowe vibes to it, too, so it's great. You know, unfortunately, we don't have much time to, but I mean, these are great stories. They're in this book, as are these photographs. And so to our listeners, I'm just going to say, check this book out. It's a great one. And thank you, Michael Goldberg, for joining us here on State of the Bay.
Yeah, the book is called Jukebox Photographs 1967 to 2023. And thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and the photos from the Jukebox will be on display through September 22nd at the Haight Street Art Center in San Francisco, where they're part of an exhibit called We Are the One, San Francisco Punk, 1970s and 1980s. And for links to Michael's new book, go to our page, State of the Bay at KALW.org. And that's it for State of the Bay this week. We'll hope you join us next. You'll join us next Monday at 6 when San Francisco's Tom Steyer joins us to talk about his new book, Cheaper, Faster, and Better. And remember, subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen and never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. If you have questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, send us an email, stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Heather Hughes, Wendy Holcomb, and Ann Harper. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.